On the Eve of Pearl Harbor. General Oshima was a great lover of German-Austrian classical music, and despite the gravity and tenseness of the situation, he took off for Austria to enjoy a Mozart festival. But he was not permitted to listen to the great Austrian composer's lovely music for long. An urgent call on December 1st brought him rushing back to his embassy in Berlin, where he found new instructions to get busy and sign up Germany on the dotted line. There was no time to lose. And now, when cornered, Ribbentrop stalled, apparently realizing fully for the first time the consequences of his rash promises to the Japanese. The Nazi foreign minister grew exceedingly cool and evasive. He told Oshima late on the evening of December 1st that he would first have to consult the Führer before making any definite commitment. The Japanese ambassador returned to the Wilhelmstrasse on Wednesday, the 3rd, to press his case, but again Ribbentrop put him off. To Oshima's pleas that the situation had become extremely critical, the foreign minister replied that while he personally was for a written agreement, the matter would have to wait until the Führer returned from headquarters later in the week. Actually, as Chano noted in his diary, not without a sign of glee, Hitler had flown to the southern front in Russia to see General von Kleist, whose armies continued to fall back under the pressure of an unexpected offensive. The Japanese, by this time, had also turned to Mussolini, who was not at any front. On December 3rd, the Japanese ambassador in Rome called on the Duce and formally asked Italy to declare war on the United States in accordance with the Tripartite Pact as soon as the conflict with America should begin. The ambassador also wanted a treaty specifying that there would be no separate peace. The Japanese interpreter, Chano noted in his diary, was trembling like a leaf. As for the Duce, he was pleased to comply after consultation with Berlin. The German capital, Chano found the next day, had grown extremely cautious. "Maybe they will go ahead," he began his diary on December 4th, "because they can't do otherwise. But the idea of provoking American intervention is less and less liked by the Germans. Mussolini, on the other hand, is happy about it." Regardless of Ribbentrop's opinion, which Hitler surprisingly still paid some attention to, the decision as to whether Germany would give a formal guarantee to Japan could be taken only by the Nazi warlord himself. During the night of December 4th to 5th, the foreign minister apparently got the Führer's go-ahead, and at 3 a.m. he handed General Oshima a draft of the requested treaty in which Germany would join Japan in war against the United States and agree not to make a separate peace. Having taken the fateful plunge and followed his leader in reversing a policy that had been clung to stubbornly for 2 years, he could not refrain from seeing that his Italian ally promptly followed suit. "A night interrupted by Ribbentrop's restiveness," Chano began his diary on December 5th. "After having delayed 2 days, he now hasn't a minute to lose in answering the Japanese, and at 3 o'clock in the morning he sends Ambassador Mackensen to my house to submit a plan for a tripartite pact of Japanese intervention and the promise not to make a separate peace. They wanted me to wake up the Duce, but I did not do it, and the Duce was very pleased." The Japanese had a draft treaty approved by both Hitler and Mussolini, but they did not yet have it signed, and this worried them. They suspected that the Führer was stalling because he wanted a quid pro quo. If Germany joined Japan in the war against the United States, Japan would have to join Germany in the war against Russia. In his telegram of instructions to Oshima on November 30th, the Japanese foreign minister had given some advice on how to handle this ticklish problem if the Germans and Italians raised it. "If they question you about our attitude toward the Soviet, say that we have already clarified our attitude toward the Russians in our statement of last July. Say that by our present moves southward we do not mean to relax our pressure against the Soviet, and that if Russia joins hands tighter with England and the United States and resists us with hostilities, we are ready to turn upon her with all our might. However, right now it is to our advantage to stress the South, and for the time being we would prefer to refrain from any direct moves in the North." December 6th came. Zhukov that very day launched his counteroffensive in front of Moscow, and the German armies reeled back in the snow and bitter cold. There was all the more reason for Hitler to demand his quid pro quo. On this question there was great uneasiness in the Foreign Office in Tokyo. The Naval Task Force was now within flying distance of Pearl Harbor for its carrier planes. So far, miraculously, it had not been discovered by American ships or aircraft. But it might be any moment. A long message was being radioed from Tokyo to Nomura and Kurusu in Washington, instructing them to call on Secretary Hull at precisely 1 p.m. the next day, Sunday, December 7th, to present Japan's rejection of the latest American proposals, and stressing that the negotiations were de facto ruptured. In desperation, Tokyo turned to Berlin for a written guarantee of German support. The Japanese warlords still did not trust the Germans enough to inform them of the blow against the United States, which would fall the next day. But they were more worried than ever that Hitler would refrain from giving his guarantee unless Japan agreed to take on not only the United States and Great Britain, but the Soviet Union as well. In this predicament, Togo got off a long message to Ambassador Oshima in Berlin, urging him to somehow stall the Germans on the Russian matter and not to give in unless it became absolutely necessary. Deluded though they were about their ability to deal with the Americans and the British, the Japanese generals and admirals retained enough sense to realize that they could not fight the Russians at the same time, even with German help. Togo's instructions to Oshima on that fateful Saturday, December 6th, which are among the intercepted messages decoded by Secretary Hull's expert decipherers, give an interesting insight into the diplomacy practiced by the Nipponese with the Third Reich at the 11th hour. "We would like to avoid an armed clash with Russia until strategic circumstances permit it. So get the German government to understand this position of ours and negotiate with them so that at least for the present they will not insist upon exchanging diplomatic notes on this question. Explain to them at considerable length that insofar as American materials being shipped to Soviet Russia, they are neither of high quality nor of large quantity, and that in case we start our war with the United States, we will capture all American ships destined for Soviet Russia. Please endeavor to come to an understanding on this line. However, should Ribbentrop insist upon our giving a guarantee in this matter, since in that case we shall have no other recourse, make a statement to the effect that we would, as a matter of principle, prevent war materials from being shipped from the United States to Soviet Russia via Japanese waters, and get them to agree to a procedure permitting the addition of a statement to the effect that, so long as strategic reasons continue to make it necessary for us to keep Soviet Russia from fighting Japan, what I mean is that we cannot capture Soviet ships, we cannot carry this out thoroughly. In case the German government refuses to agree with the above and makes their approval of this question absolutely conditional upon our participation in the war and upon our concluding a treaty against making a separate peace, we have no way but to postpone the conclusion of such a treaty." The Japanese need not have worried so much. For reasons unknown to the Tokyo militarists or to anyone else, and which defy logic and understanding, Hitler did not insist on Japan's taking on Russia along with the United States and Britain, though if he had, the course of the war conceivably might have been different. At any rate, the Japanese on this Saturday evening of December 6, 1941, were determined to strike a telling blow against the United States in the Pacific, though no one in Washington or Berlin knew just where or even exactly when. That morning, the British Admiralty had tipped off the American government that a large Japanese invasion fleet had been observed heading across the Gulf of Siam for the Isthmus of Kra, which indicated that the Nipponese were striking first at Thailand and perhaps Malaya. At 9 p.m., President Roosevelt got off a personal message to the Emperor of Japan, imploring him to join him in finding ways of dispelling the dark clouds, and at the same time warning him that a thrust of the Japanese military forces into Southeast Asia would create a situation that was unthinkable. At the Navy Department, intelligence officers drew up their latest report on the location of the major warships of the Japanese Navy. It listed most of them as being in home ports, including all the carriers and other warships of the task force which, at that very moment, had steamed to within 300 miles of Pearl Harbor and was tuning up its bombers to take off at dawn. On that Saturday evening, too, the Navy Department informed the President and Mr. Hull that the Japanese embassy was destroying its codes. It had first had to decipher Togo's long message, which had dribbled in all afternoon in 14 parts. The Navy decoders were also deciphering it as fast as it came in, and by 9:30 p.m. a naval officer was at the White House with translations of the first 13 parts. Mr. Roosevelt, who was with Harry Hopkins in the study, read it and said, "This means war." But exactly when and just where, the message did not say, and the President did not know. Even Admiral Nomura did not know. Nor, far off in Eastern Europe, did Adolf Hitler. He knew less than Roosevelt. Hitler declares war. The Japanese onslaught on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor at 7:30 a.m. local time on Sunday, December 7, 1941, caught Berlin as completely by surprise as it did Washington. Though Hitler had made an oral promise to Matsuoka that Germany would join Japan in a war against the United States, and Ribbentrop had made another to Ambassador Oshima, the assurance had not yet been signed, and the Japanese had not breathed a word to the Germans about Pearl Harbor. It was long believed by many that Hitler knew in advance the exact hour of the attack on Pearl Harbor, but I have been unable to find a single scrap of evidence in the secret German papers to substantiate it. Besides, at this moment, Hitler was fully occupied trying to rally his faltering generals and retreating troops in Russia. Night had fallen in Berlin when the Foreign Broadcast Monitoring Service first picked up the news of the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. When an official of the Foreign Office press department telephoned Ribbentrop the world-shaking news, he at first refused to believe it and was extremely angry at being disturbed. The report was probably a propaganda trick of the enemy, he said, and ordered that he be left undisturbed until morning. So probably Ribbentrop for once told the truth when he testified on the stand at Nuremberg that this attack came as a complete surprise to us. We had considered the possibility of Japan's attacking Singapore, or perhaps Hong Kong, but we never considered an attack on the United States as being to our advantage. However, contrary to what he told the tribunal, he was exceedingly happy about it, or so he struck Chano. A night telephone call from Ribbentrop, Chano began his diary on December 8th. He is joyful over the Japanese attack on the United States. He is so happy, in fact, that I can't but congratulate him, even though I am not so sure about the advantage. Mussolini was also happy. For a long time now, he has been in favor of clarifying the position between America and the Axis. At 1 p.m. on Monday, December 8th, General Oshima went to the Wilhelmstrasse to get Ribbentrop to clarify Germany's position. He demanded a formal declaration of war on the United States at once. Ribbentrop replied, Oshima radioed Tokyo, that Hitler was then in the midst of a conference at General Headquarters discussing how the formalities of declaring war could be carried out so as to make a good impression on the German people, and that he would transmit your wish to him at once and do whatever he was able to have it carried out promptly. The Nazi foreign minister also informed the ambassador, according to the latter's message to Tokyo, that on that very morning of the 8th, Hitler issued orders to the German Navy to attack American ships whenever and wherever they may meet them. But the dictator stalled on a declaration of war. In Tokyo at the same time, Foreign Minister Togo was telling Ambassador Ott, "The Japanese government expects that now Germany too will speedily declare war on the United States." The Führer, according to the notation in his daily calendar book, hurried back to Berlin on the night of December 8th, arriving there at 11 o'clock the next morning. Ribbentrop claimed at Nuremberg that he pointed out to the leader that Germany did not necessarily have to declare war on America under the terms of the Tripartite Pact, since Japan was obviously the aggressor. "The text of the Tripartite Pact bound us to assist Japan only in case of an attack against Japan herself. I went to see the Führer, explained the legal aspect of the situation, and told him that, although we welcomed a new ally against England, it meant we had a new opponent to deal with as well, if we declared war on the United States. I told him that according to the stipulation of the Three-Power Pact, since Japan had attacked, we would not have to declare war formally. The Führer thought this matter over quite a while, and then he gave me a very clear decision. If we don't stand on the side of Japan, he said, the pact is politically dead, but that is not the main reason. The chief reason is that the United States already is shooting against our ships. They have been a forceful factor in this war, and through their actions have already created a situation of war. The Führer was of the opinion at that moment that it was quite evident that the United States would now make war against Germany. Therefore, he ordered me to hand over the passports to the American representative. This was a decision that Roosevelt and Hull in Washington had been confidently waiting for. There had been some pressure on them to have Congress declare war on Germany and Italy on December 8th when that step was taken against Japan. But they had decided to wait. The bombing at Pearl Harbor had taken them off one hook, and certain information in their possession led them to believe that the headstrong Nazi dictator would take them off a second hook. My own impression in Washington at that moment was that it might be difficult for President Roosevelt to get Congress to declare war on Germany. There seemed to be a strong feeling in both houses, as well as in the Army and Navy, that the country ought to concentrate its efforts on defeating Japan and not take on the additional burden of fighting Germany at the same time. Hans Thompson, the German chargé in Washington, who, like all the other Nazi envoys abroad, was usually kept ignorant of what Hitler and Ribbentrop were conniving, reported this sentiment to Berlin. Immediately after the President's speech to Congress on the morning of December 8th, calling for a declaration of war on Japan, Thompson radioed Berlin, "The fact that he, Roosevelt, did not mention Germany and Italy with one word shows that he will try at first to avoid sharpening the situation in the Atlantic." On the evening of the same day, Thompson got off another dispatch on the subject. Whether Roosevelt will demand declaration of war on Germany and Italy is uncertain. From the standpoint of the American military leaders, it would be logical to avoid everything which could lead to a two-front war. In several dispatches just prior to Pearl Harbor, the German chargé had emphasized that the United States simply was not prepared for a two-front war. On December 4th, he had radioed the revelations in the Chicago Tribune of the war plans of the American High Command on preparations and prospects for defeating Germany and her allies. "Report confirms," he said, "that full participation of America in war is not to be expected before July 1943. Military measures against Japan are of defensive character." In his message to Berlin on the evening of December 8th, Thompson stressed that Pearl Harbor was certain to bring relief to Germany from America's belligerent activities in the Atlantic. "War with Japan," he reported, "means transferring of all energy to America's own rearmament, a corresponding shrinking of lend-lease help, and a shifting of all activity to the Pacific." For the exchange of dispatches between the Wilhelmstrasse and the German embassy in Washington during this period, I am indebted to the State Department, which gave me access to them. They will be published later in the Documents on German Foreign Policy series. Roosevelt and Hull had pondered the intercepted message of Ambassador Oshima from Berlin to Tokyo on November 29th, in which Ribbentrop had assured the Japanese that Germany would join Japan if she became engaged in a war against the United States. There was nothing in that assurance which made German aid conditional upon who was the aggressor. It was a blank check, and the Americans had no doubt that the Japanese were now clamoring in Berlin that it be honored. It was honored, but only after the Nazi warlord again hesitated. He had convoked the Reichstag to meet on December 9th, the day of his arrival in Berlin, but he postponed it for 2 days until the 11th. Apparently, as Ribbentrop later reported, he had made up his mind. He was fed up with the attacks made by Roosevelt on him and on Nazism. His patience was exhausted by the warlike acts of the U.S. Navy against German U-boats in the Atlantic, about which Raeder had continually nagged him for nearly a year. He had a growing hatred for America and Americans, and, what was worse for him in the long run, a growing tendency to disastrously underestimate the potential strength of the United States. "I don't see much future for the Americans," he told his cronies a month later during a monologue at headquarters on January 7, 1942. "It's a decayed country, and they have their racial problem and the problem of social inequalities. My feelings against Americanism are feelings of hatred and deep repugnance. Everything about the behavior of American society reveals that it's half Judaized and the other half negrified. How can one expect a state like that to hold together? A country where everything is built on the dollar." Hitler's Secret Conversations, page 155. At the same time, he grossly overestimated Japan's military power. In fact, he seems to have believed that once the Japanese, whose navy he believed to be the most powerful in the world, had disposed of the British and Americans in the Pacific, they would turn on Russia and thus help him finish his great conquest in the East. He actually told some of his followers a few months later that he thought Japan's entry into the war had been of exceptional value to us, if only because of the date chosen. It was, in effect, at the moment when the surprises of the Russian winter were pressing most heavily on the morale of our people, and when everybody in Germany was oppressed by the certainty that sooner or later the United States would come into the conflict. Japanese intervention, therefore, was, from our point of view, most opportune. There is also no doubt that Japan's sneaky and mighty blow against the American fleet at Pearl Harbor kindled his admiration. and all the more so because it was the kind of surprise he had been so proud of pulling off so often himself. He expressed this to Ambassador Oshima on December 14th when he awarded him the Grand Cross of the Order of Merit of the German Eagle in gold. "You gave the right declaration of war. This method is the only proper one." It corresponded, he said, to his own system. That is, to negotiate as long as possible. But if one sees that the other is interested only in putting one off, in shaming and humiliating one, and is not willing to come to an agreement, then one should strike, indeed as hard as possible, and not waste time declaring war. It was heartwarming to him to hear of the first operations of the Japanese. He himself negotiated with infinite patience at times, for example, with Poland and also with Russia. When he then realized that the other did not want to come to an agreement, he struck suddenly and without formalities. He would continue to go this way in the future. There was one other reason for Hitler's deciding in such haste to add the United States to the formidable list of his enemies. Dr. Schmidt, who was in and out of the Chancellery and Foreign Office that week, put his finger on it. "I got the impression," he later wrote, "that with his inveterate desire for prestige, Hitler, who was expecting an American declaration of war, wanted to get his declaration in first." The Nazi warlord confirmed this in his speech to the Reichstag on December 11th. "We will always strike first," he told the cheering deputies. "We will always deal the first blow." Indeed, Berlin was so fearful on December 10th that America might declare war first that Ribbentrop sternly admonished Thompson, the German chargé in Washington, about committing any indiscretion which might tip off the State Department to what Hitler planned to do on the following day. In a long radiogram on the 10th, the Nazi foreign minister filed the text of the declaration he would make in Berlin to the U.S. chargé d'affaires at precisely 2:30 p.m. on December 11th. Thompson was instructed to call on Hull exactly 1 hour later at 3:30 p.m. Berlin time, hand the Secretary of State a copy of the declaration, ask for his passport, and turn over Germany's diplomatic representation to Switzerland. At the end of the message, Ribbentrop warned Thompson not to have any contact with the State Department before delivering his note. "We wish to avoid under all circumstances," the warning said, "that the government there beats us to such a step." Whatever hesitations led Hitler to postpone the Reichstag session by 2 days, it is evident from the captured exchange of messages between the Wilhelmstrasse and the German embassy in Washington, and from other Foreign Office papers, that the Führer actually made his fateful decision to declare war on the United States on December 9th, the day he arrived in the capital from headquarters on the Russian front. The Nazi dictator appears to have wanted the 2 extra days not for further reflection, but to prepare carefully his Reichstag speech, so that it would make the proper impression on the German people, of whose memories of America's decisive role in the First World War Hitler was quite aware. Hans Dieckhoff, who was still officially the German ambassador to the United States, but who had been cooling his heels in the Wilhelmstrasse ever since both countries withdrew their chief envoys in the autumn of 1938, was put to work on December 9th to draw up a long list of Roosevelt's anti-German activities for the Führer's Reichstag address. Dieckhoff, whom Hassel thought temperamentally submissive, had drawn up just a week before at the request of Ribbentrop a long memorandum entitled "Principles for Influencing American Public Opinion." Among his 11 principles were: real danger to America is Roosevelt himself, influence of Jews on Roosevelt, Frankfurter, Baruch, Benjamin Cohen, Samuel Rosenman, Henry Morgenthau, etc. The slogan for every American mother must be, "I didn't raise my boy to die for Britain," from the Foreign Office papers not yet published. Some Americans in the State Department and in our embassy in Berlin thought rather highly of Dieckhoff and believed him to be anti-Nazi. My own feeling was that he lacked the guts to be. He served Hitler to the end, from 1943 to 1945 as the Nazi ambassador to Franco-Spain. Also on December 9th, Thompson in Washington was instructed to burn his secret codes and confidential papers. "Measures carried out as ordered," he flashed to Berlin at 11:30 a.m. on that day. For the first time, he became aware of what was going on in Berlin, and during the evening tipped the Wilhelmstrasse that apparently the American government knew too. "Believed here," he said, "that within 24 hours Germany will declare war on the United States, or at least break off diplomatic relations." Thompson also urged Berlin to arrest the American correspondents there in retaliation for the arrest of a handful of German newsmen in the United States. A Foreign Office memorandum signed by Undersecretary Ernst Wurmann on December 10th declares that all American correspondents in Germany were ordered arrested as a reprisal. Excepted was Guido Enderes, chief correspondent in Berlin of the New York Times, because, Wurmann wrote, of his proved friendliness to Germany. This may be unfair to the late Enderes, who was in ill health at the time and who, mainly for that reason, perhaps was not arrested. Hitler in the Reichstag, December 11th. Hitler's address on December 11th to the robots of the Reichstag in defense of his declaration of war on the United States was devoted mainly to hurling personal insults at Franklin D. Roosevelt, to charging that the president had provoked war in order to cover up the failures of the New Deal, and to thundering that this man alone, backed by the millionaires and the Jews, was responsible for the Second World War. All the accumulated, pent-up resentment at a man who had stood from the first in his way toward world dominion, who had continually taunted him, who had provided massive aid to Britain at a moment when it seemed that battered island nation would fall, and whose navy was frustrating him in the Atlantic, burst forth in violent wrath. Permit me to define my attitude to that other world, which has its representative in that man who, while our soldiers are fighting in snow and ice, very tactfully likes to make his chats from the fireside, the man who is the main culprit of this war. I will pass over the insulting attacks made by this so-called president against me. That he calls me a gangster is uninteresting. After all, this expression was not coined in Europe but in America, no doubt because such gangsters are lacking here. Apart from this, I cannot be insulted by Roosevelt, for I consider him mad, just as Wilson was. First he incites war, then falsifies the causes, then odiously wraps himself in a cloak of Christian hypocrisy, and slowly but surely leads mankind to war, not without calling God to witness the honesty of his attack, in the approved manner of an old Freemason. Roosevelt has been guilty of a series of the worst crimes against international law. Illegal seizure of ships and other property of German and Italian nationals was coupled with the threat to and looting of those who were deprived of their liberty by being interned. Roosevelt's ever-increasing attacks finally went so far that he ordered the American Navy to attack everywhere ships under the German and Italian flags and to sink them. This in gross violation of international law. American ministers boasted of having destroyed German submarines in this criminal way. German and Italian merchant ships were attacked by American cruisers, captured, and their crews imprisoned. In this way, the sincere efforts of Germany and Italy to prevent an extension of the war and to maintain relations with the United States in spite of the unbearable provocations which have been carried on for years by President Roosevelt have been frustrated. What was Roosevelt's motive to intensify anti-German feeling to the pitch of war, Hitler asked. He gave two explanations. I understand only too well that a worldwide distance separates Roosevelt's ideas and my ideas. Roosevelt comes from a rich family and belongs to the class whose path is smoothed in the democracies. I was only the child of a small, poor family and had to fight my way by work and industry. When the Great War came, Roosevelt occupied a position where he got to know only its pleasant consequences, enjoyed by those who do business while others bleed. I was only one of those who carried out orders as an ordinary soldier, and naturally returned from the war just as poor as I was in the autumn of 1914. I shared the fate of millions, and Franklin Roosevelt only the fate of the so-called upper 10,000. After the war, Roosevelt tried his hand at financial speculations. He made profits out of inflation, out of the misery of others, while I lay in a hospital. Hitler continued at some length with this singular comparison before he reached his second point, that Roosevelt had reverted to war to escape the consequences of his failure as president. National Socialism came to power in Germany in the same year as Roosevelt was elected president. He took over a state in a very poor economic condition, and I took over the Reich faced with complete ruin, thanks to democracy. While an unprecedented revival of economic life, culture, and art took place in Germany under National Socialist leadership, President Roosevelt did not succeed in bringing about even the slightest improvement in his own country. This is not surprising if one bears in mind that the men he had called to support him, or rather the men who had called him, belonged to the Jewish element, whose interests are all for disintegration and never for order. Roosevelt's New Deal legislation was all wrong. There can be no doubt that a continuation of this economic policy would have undone this president in peacetime, in spite of all his dialectical skill. In a European state, he would surely have come eventually before a state court on a charge of deliberate waste of the national wealth, and he would scarcely have escaped at the hands of a civil court on a charge of criminal business methods. Hitler knew that this assessment of the New Deal was shared, in part at least, by the American isolationists and a considerable portion of the business community, and he sought to make the most of it, ignorant of the fact that on Pearl Harbor Day these groups, like all others in America, had rallied to the support of their country. This fact was realized, he continued, alluding to these groups, and fully appreciated by many Americans, including some of high standing. A threatening opposition was gathering over the head of this man. He guessed that the only salvation for him lay in diverting public attention from home to foreign policy. He was strengthened in this by the Jews around him. The full diabolical meanness of Jewry rallied around this man, and he stretched out his hands. Thus began the increasing efforts of the American president to create conflicts. For years this man harbored one desire, that a conflict should break out somewhere in the world. There followed a long recital of Roosevelt's efforts in this direction, beginning with the quarantine speech in Chicago in 1937. Now he, Roosevelt, is seized, Hitler cried at one point, with fear that if peace is brought about in Europe, his squandering of millions of money on armaments will be looked upon as plain fraud, since nobody will attack America. And then he himself must provoke this attack upon his country. The Nazi dictator seemed relieved that the break had come, and he sought to share his sense of relief with the German people. I think you have all found it a relief now that, at last, one state has been the first to take the step of protesting against this historically unique and shameless ill-treatment of truth and of right. The fact that the Japanese government, which has been negotiating for years with this man, has at last become tired of being mocked by him in such an unworthy way, fills us all, the German people and, I think, all other decent people in the world, with deep satisfaction. The President of the United States ought finally to understand, I say this only because of his limited intellect, that we know that the aim of his struggle is to destroy one state after another. As for the German nation, it needs charity neither from Mr. Roosevelt nor from Mr. Churchill, let alone from Mr. Eden. It wants only its rights. It will secure for itself this right to live even if thousands of Churchills and Roosevelts conspire against it. I have therefore arranged for passports to be handed to the American chargé d'affaires today, and the following... At this point, the deputies of the Reichstag leaped to their feet cheering, and the Führer's words were drowned in the bedlam. Shortly afterward, at 2:30 p.m., Ribbentrop, in one of his most frigid poses, received Leland Morris, the American chargé d'affaires in Berlin, and while keeping him standing, read out Germany's declaration of war, handed him a copy, and icily dismissed him. Although Germany, for her part, said the declaration, has always strictly observed the rules of international law in her dealings with the United States throughout the present war, the government of the United States has finally proceeded to overt acts of war against Germany. It has, therefore, virtually created a state of war. The Reich government, therefore, breaks off all diplomatic relations with the United States and declares that under these circumstances brought about by President Roosevelt, Germany too considers herself to be at war with the United States, as from today. The final act in the day's drama was the signing of a tripartite agreement by Germany, Italy, and Japan, declaring their unshakable determination not to lay down arms until the joint war against the United States and England reaches a successful conclusion, and not to conclude a separate peace. Adolf Hitler, who a bare 6 months before had faced only a beleaguered Britain in a war which seemed to him as good as won, now, by deliberate choice, had arrayed against him the three greatest industrial powers in the world in a struggle in which military might depended largely in the long run on economic strength. Those three enemy countries together also had a great preponderance of manpower over the three Axis nations. Neither Hitler nor his generals nor his admirals seemed to have weighed those sobering facts on that eventful December day as the year 1941 drew toward a close. General Halder, the intelligent chief of the general staff, did not even note in his diary on December 11th that Germany had declared war on the United States. He mentioned only that in the evening he attended a lecture by a naval captain on the background of the Japanese-American Sea War. The rest of his diary, understandably perhaps, was taken up with the continued bad news from most sectors of the hard-pressed Russian front. There was no room in his thoughts for an eventual day when his weakened armies might also have to confront fresh troops from the New World. Admiral Raeder actually welcomed Hitler's move. He conferred with the Führer on the following day, December 12th. The situation in the Atlantic, he assured him, will be eased by Japan's successful intervention. And warming up to his subject, he added, "Reports have already been received of the transfer of some American battleships from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It is certain that light forces, especially destroyers, will be required in increased numbers in the Pacific. The need for transport ships will be very great, so that a withdrawal of American merchant ships from the Atlantic can be expected. The strain on British merchant shipping will increase." Hitler, having taken his plunge and with such reckless bravado, now suddenly was prey to doubts. He had some questions to put to the Grand Admiral. Did he believe that the enemy will in the near future take steps to occupy the Azores, the Cape Verdes, and perhaps even to attack Dakar, in order to win back prestige lost as the result of the setbacks in the Pacific? Raeder did not think so. "The U.S., he answered, "will have to concentrate all her strength in the Pacific during the next few months. Britain will not want to run any risks after her severe losses of big ships. It is hardly likely that transport tonnage is available for such occupation tasks or for bringing up supplies." 2 days before, on December 10th, Japanese planes had sunk two British battleships, the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, off the coast of Malaya. Coupled with the crippling American losses in battleships at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, this blow gave the Japanese fleet complete supremacy in the Pacific, the China Sea, and the Indian Ocean. "In all the war," Churchill wrote later of the loss of the two great ships, "I never received a more direct shock." Hitler had a more important question to pose. "Is there any possibility," he asked, "that the USA and Britain will abandon East Asia for a time in order to crush Germany and Italy first?" Here again the Grand Admiral was reassuring. "It is improbable," he answered, "that the enemy will give up East Asia even temporarily. By so doing, Britain would endanger India very seriously, and the U.S. cannot withdraw her fleet from the Pacific as long as the Japanese fleet has the upper hand." Raeder further tried to cheer up the Führer by informing him that six large submarines were to proceed as quickly as possible to the east coast of the United States. With the situation in Russia being what it was, not to mention that in North Africa, where Rommel was also retreating, the thoughts of the German Supreme Commander and his military chiefs quickly turned from the new enemy, which they were sure would have its hands full in the Pacific far away. Their thoughts were not to return to it before another year had passed, the most fateful year of the war, in which the great turning point would come, irrevocably deciding not only the outcome of the conflict, which all through 1941 the Germans had believed almost over, almost won, but the fate of the Third Reich, whose astounding early victories had raised it so quickly to such a giddy height, and which Hitler sincerely believed, and said, would flourish for 1,000 years. Halder's scribblings in his diary grew ominous as New Year's, 1942, drew near. "Another dark day," he began his journal on December 30th, 1941, and again on the last day of the year. The chief of the German General Staff had a presentiment of terrible things to come.